Can we be excused now? Jenny said. We want to go skateboarding. The skateboards are in the car, Jenny's friend Megan said.
Take your plates over to the sink, Robert said. And then you can go skateboarding, I guess. But don't go far. Stay in the neighborhood, he said, and be careful.
Is it all right? Carol said. Sure it is, Joanne said. It's fine. I wish I had a skateboard. If I did, I'd join them.
But mostly good times,
Robert said, going on with what he'd been saying about their student days.
Right?
He said, catching Joanne's eye and grinning. Joanne nodded. Those were the days, all right, Carol said. Nick had the feeling that Joanne wanted to ask them something about Bill Daly, but she didn't. She smiled, held the smile a moment too long, and then asked if anybody would like more coffee.
I'll have some more, thanks, Robert said.
Carol said, nope, and put the palm of her hand over her cup. Nick shook his head.
So tell me about salmon fishing, Robert said to Nick. Nothing much to tell, Nick said. You get up early and you go out on the water, and if the wind isn't blowing and it doesn't rain on you, and the fish are in and you're rigged up properly, you might get a strike. The odds are that, if you're lucky, you'll land one out of every four fish that hit. Some men devote their lives to it, I guess. I fish some in the summer months, and that's it.
Do you fish out of a boat or what?
Robert said. He said this as if it was an afterthought. He wasn't really interested, Nick felt, but thought he had to say more since he'd brought it up. I have a boat, Nick said. It's berthed down at the marina. Robert nodded slowly. Joanne poured his coffee, and Robert looked at her and grinned.
Thanks, babe, he said.
Nick and Joanne saw Carol and Robert every 6 months or so, more often than Nick would have liked, to tell the truth. It wasn't that he disliked them. He did like them. He liked them better, in fact, than any other of Joanne's friends he'd met. He liked Robert's bitter sense of humor and the way he had of telling a story, making it seem funnier, probably, than it really was. He liked Carol, too. She was a pretty, cheerful woman who still did an occasional acrylic painting. Nick and Joanne had hung one of her paintings, a gift, on their bedroom wall. Carol had never been anything but pleasant to Nick during the times they'd been in each other's company. But sometimes, when Robert and Joanne were reminiscing over the past, Nick would find himself looking across the room at Carol, who would hold his look, smile, and then give a little shake of her head, as if none of this talk of the past were of any consequence. Still, from time to time when they were all together, Nick couldn't help feeling that an unspoken judgment was being made, and that Robert, if not Carol, still blamed him for breaking up Joanne's marriage with Bill and ending their happy foursome. They saw each other in Aberdeen at least twice a year, once at the beginning of summer, and once again near the end. Robert and Carol and Jenny, their 10-year-old, made a loop through town on their way to the rainforest country of the Olympic Peninsula, heading for a lodge they knew about at a place called Agate Beach, where Jenny would hunt for agates and fill up a leather pouch with stones that she took back to Seattle for polishing. The three never stayed overnight with Nick and Joanne. It occurred to Nick they'd never been asked to stay, for one thing, though he was sure that Joanne would have been pleased enough to have them if Nick suggested it. But he hadn't. On each of their visits, they arrived in time for breakfast, or else they showed up just before lunch. Carol always called ahead to make the arrangements. They were punctual, which Nick appreciated. Nick liked them, but somehow he was always made uneasy in their company, too. They'd never, not once, talked about Bill Daly in Nick's presence, or even so much as mentioned the man's name. Nevertheless, when the four of them were together, Nick was somehow made to feel that Daly was never very far from anyone's thoughts. Nick had taken Daly's wife away from him, and now these old friends of Daly's were in the house of the man who'd committed that callous indiscretion, the man who'd turned all their lives upside down for a while. Wasn't it a kind of betrayal for Robert and Carol to be friends with the man who'd done this? To actually break bread in the man's house and see him put his arm lovingly around the shoulders of the woman who used to be the wife of the man they loved? Don't go far, honey, Carol said to Jenny as the girls passed through the kitchen again. We have to be leaving soon. We won't, Jenny said. We'll just skate out in front.
See that you do, Robert said. We'll go pretty soon, you kids. He looked at his watch.
The door closed behind the children, and the grown-ups went back to a subject they'd touched on earlier that morning, terrorism. Robert was an art teacher in one of the Seattle high schools, and Carol worked in a boutique near the Pike Place Market. Between the two of them, they didn't know anyone who was going to Europe or the Middle East that summer. In fact, several people, friends of theirs, had canceled their vacation plans to Italy and Greece.
See America first is my motto, Robert said.
He went on to tell something about his mother and stepfather, who'd just come back from 2 weeks in Rome. Their luggage had been lost for 3 days. That was the first thing that had happened. Then, the second night in Rome, walking down the Via Veneto to a restaurant not far from their hotel, the street patrolled by men in uniform carrying machine guns, his mother had her purse snatched by a thief on a bicycle. 2 days later, when they drove a rental car about 30 miles from Rome, somebody slashed a tire and stole the hood off the car while they were in a museum.
They didn't take the battery or anything, you understand, Robert said. They wanted the hood. Can you beat it?
What did they want with the hood? Joanne asked.
Who knows, Robert said. But in any case, it's getting worse for people over there, for tourists, since we bombed. What do you guys think about the bombing? I think it's just going to make things worse for Americans. Everybody's a target now.
Nick stirred his coffee and sipped it before saying,
I don't know any longer. I really don't. In my mind, I keep seeing all those bodies lying in pools of blood in the airports. I just don't know.
He stirred his coffee some more.
The guys I've talked to over here think that we should have dropped a few more bombs maybe while we were at it. I heard somebody say they should have turned the place into a parking lot while they were at it. I don't know what we should or shouldn't do over there, but we had to do something, I think.
Well, that's a little severe, isn't it? Robert said. A parking lot? Like, nuke the place, you know?
I said I don't know what they should have done, but some kind of response was necessary.
Diplomacy, Robert said. Economic sanctions. Let them feel it in their pocketbooks. Then they'll straighten up and fly right.
Should I make more coffee? Joanne said. It won't take a minute. Who wants some cantaloupe?
She moved her chair back and got up from the table.
I can't eat another bite, Carol said.
Me neither, Robert said. I'm fine.
He seemed to want to go on with what they were talking about, and then he stopped.
Nick, sometime I'll come down here and go fishing with you. When's the best time to go?
Do it, Nick said. You're welcome to come anytime. Come over and stay as long as you'd like. July is the best month, but August is good too. Even the first week or two of September.
He started to say something about how swell it was fishing in the evenings when most of the boats had gone in. He started to say something about the time he'd hooked a big one in the moonlight. Robert seemed to consider this for a minute. He drank some of his coffee.
I'll do it. I'll come this summer, in July if that's all right.
It's fine, Nick said.
What will I need in the way of equipment?
Robert said, interested.
Just bring yourself, Nick said. I have plenty of gear.
You can use my pole,
Joanne said.
But then you couldn't fish, Robert said.
And suddenly that was the end of the talk about fishing.
Somehow, Nick could see, the prospect of sitting together in a boat for hours on end made Robert and him both feel uneasy. No, frankly, he couldn't see any more for their relationship than sitting here in this nice kitchen twice a year eating breakfast and lingering over coffee. It was pleasant enough, and it was just enough time spent together. More than this was just not in the cards. Lately, he'd even passed up an occasional trip to Seattle with Joanne because he knew she'd want to stop at the end of the day at Carol and Robert's for coffee. Nick would make an excuse and stay home. He'd say he was too busy at the lumber yard that he managed. On one occasion, Joanne had spent the night with Carol and Robert, and when she came home, she seemed to Nick to be remote and thoughtful for a few days. When he asked her about the visit, she said it had been fine and that they'd sat up late after dinner talking. Nick knew they must have talked about Bill Daly. He was certain they had. And he found himself irritated for a few weeks. But so what if they'd talked about Daly? Joanne was Nick's now. Once he would have killed for her. He loved her still, and she loved him. But he didn't feel that obsessive now. No, he wouldn't kill for her now.
and he had a hard time understanding how he'd ever felt that way in the first place. He didn't think that she, or anybody for that matter, could ever be worth killing somebody else for. Joanne stood up and began clearing the plates from the table.
Let me help, Carol said.
Nick put his arm around Joanne's waist and squeezed her, as if vaguely ashamed of what he'd been thinking. Joanne stood still, close to Nick's chair. She let him hold her. Then her face reddened slightly and she moved a little, and Nick let go of her. The children, Jenny and Megan, opened the door and rushed into the kitchen, carrying their skateboards.
There's a fire down the street, Jenny said.
Somebody's house is burning, Megan said.
A fire? Carol said. If it's a real fire, stay away from it.
I didn't hear any fire trucks, Joanne said. Did you guys hear fire trucks?
I didn't either, Robert said. You kids go play now. We don't have much longer.
Nick stepped to the bay window and looked out, but nothing out of the ordinary seemed to be happening. The idea of a house fire on the block in clear, sunny weather at 11 in the morning was incomprehensible. Besides, there had been no alarms, no carloads of rubberneckers or clang of bells, or wail of sirens and hiss of air brakes. It seemed to Nick it had to be part of a game the children were playing.
This was a wonderful breakfast, Carol said. I loved it. I feel like I could roll over and go to sleep.
Why don't you? Joanne said. We have that extra room upstairs. Let the kids play and you guys take yourselves a nap before starting off.
Go ahead, Nick said. Sure. Carol's just kidding, of course, Robert said. We couldn't do anything like that, could we, Carol?
Robert looked at her.
Oh, no, not really, Carol said and laughed. But everything was so good, as always. A champagne brunch without the champagne.
The best kind, Nick said. Nick had quit drinking 6 years ago after being arrested for driving under the influence. He'd gone with someone to an AA meeting, decided that was the place for him, and then went every night, sometimes twice in one night, for 2 months, until the desire to drink left him, as he put it, almost as if it had never been there. But even now, though he didn't drink, he still went to a meeting every once in a while.
Speaking of drinking, Robert said.
Joe, do you remember Harry Schuster?
Dr. Harry Schuster, a bone marrow transplant man now, don't ask me how. But do you remember the Christmas party that time when he got into the fight with his wife?
Marilyn, Joanne said. Marilyn Schuster. I haven't thought of her in a long time.
Marilyn, that's right, Robert said. Because he thought she'd had too much to drink and was making eyes at...
He paused just long enough for Joanne to say, Bill.
Bill, that's right, Robert said. Anyway, first they had words and then she threw her car keys on the living room floor and said, You drive then if you're so goddamn safe, sane, and sober. And so Harry, they'd come in two cars, mind, he'd been interning at the hospital. Harry went out and drove her car 2 blocks, parked it, and then came back for his car and drove that about 2 blocks, parked, walked back to her car, drove it 2 blocks, walked to his own car and drove it a little farther, and parked and walked back to her car and drove that a few blocks, etc., etc.
They all laughed. Nick laughed, too. It was funny. Nick had heard plenty of drinking stories in his time, but he'd never heard one that had this particular spin on it.
Anyway, Robert said, to make a long story short, as they say, he drove both cars home that way. It took him 2 or 3 hours to drive 5 miles, and when he got to the house, there was Marilyn, at the table with a drink in her hand. Somebody had driven her home. Merry Christmas, she said when Harry came in the door, and I guess he decked her.
Carol whistled. Joanne said,
Anybody could see those two weren't going to make it. They were in the fast lane. A year later, they were both at the same Christmas party, only they had different partners by then.
All the drinking and driving I did, Nick said. He shook his head. I was only picked up once.
You were lucky, Joanne said.
Somebody was lucky, Robert said. The other drivers on the road were lucky.
I spent one night in jail, Nick said, and that was enough. That's when I stopped. Actually, I was in what they called detox. The doctor came around the next morning. His name was Dr. Forrester, and called each person into this little examining room and gave you the once-over.
He looked in your eyes with his pen light. He made you hold out your hands, palms up. He took your pulse and listened to your heartbeat. He'd give you a little talking to about your drinking, and then he'd tell you what time of the morning you could be released. He said I could leave at 11 o'clock. Doctor, I said, could I leave earlier, please? What's the big hurry, he said. I have to be at church at 11 o'clock, I said. I'm getting married.
What'd he say to that?
Carol said. He said, get the hell out of here, mister, but don't ever forget this, do you hear? And I didn't. I stopped drinking. I didn't even drink anything at the wedding reception that afternoon. Not a drop. That was it for me. I was too scared. Sometimes it takes something like that, a real shock to your nervous system to turn things around.
I had a kid brother who was nearly killed by a drunk driver,
Robert said.
He's still wired up and has to use a metal brace to get around.
Last call for coffee, Joanne said. Just a little, I guess, Carol said. We really have to collect those kids and get on the road. Nick looked toward the window and saw several cars pass by on the street outside. People hurried by on the sidewalk. He remembered what Jenny and the other child had said about a fire, but for God's sake, if there were a fire, there'd be sirens and engines, right? He started to get up from the table, and then he didn't.
It's crazy, he said. I remember when I was still drinking, and I'd just had what they call an alcoholic seizure. I'd fallen and hit my head on a coffee table. Lucky for me, I was in the doctor's office when it happened. I woke up in a bed in his office, and Peggy, the woman I was married to at the time, she was leaning over me, along with the doctor and the doctor's nurse. Peggy was calling my name. I had this big bandage round my head. It was like a turban. The doctor said I'd just had my first seizure, but it wouldn't be my last if I kept on drinking. I told him I'd got the message, but I just said that. I had no intention of quitting then. I told myself and my wife that it was my nerves, stress, that had caused me to faint. But that night we had a party, Peggy and me. It was something we'd planned for a couple of weeks, and we didn't see how we could call it off at the last minute and disappoint everybody. Can you imagine? So we went ahead and had the party, and everybody came, and I was still wearing the bandage. All that night I had a glass of vodka in my hand. I told people I'd cut my head on the car door.
How much longer did you keep drinking? Carol said.
Quite a while, a year or so, until I got picked up that night.
He was sober when I met him,
Joanne said and blushed as if she'd said something she shouldn't. Nick put his hand on Joanne's neck and rested his fingers there. He picked up some of the hair that lay across her neck and rubbed it between his fingers. Some more people went by the window on the sidewalk. Most of the people were in shirt sleeves and blouses. A man was carrying a little girl on his shoulders. I quit drinking about a year before I met Joanne, Nick said, as if telling them something they needed to know.
Tell them about your brother, honey,
Joanne said. Nick didn't say anything at first. He stopped rubbing Joanne's neck and took his hand away.
What happened?
Robert said, leaning forward. Nick shook his head.
What? Carol said. Nick? It's okay, if you want to tell us, that is.
How'd we get onto this stuff anyway? Nick said.
You brought it up,
Joanne said. Well, what happened, you see, was that I was trying to get sober and I felt like I couldn't do it at home, but I didn't want to have to go anyplace, like to a clinic or a recovery place, you know? And my brother had this summer house he wasn't using. This was in October. And I called him and I asked him if I could go there and stay for a week or two and try to get myself together again. At first he said yes. I began to pack a suitcase and I was thinking I was glad I had family, glad I had a brother and that he was going to help me. But pretty soon the phone rang, and it was my brother, and he said he'd talked it over with his wife, and he was sorry. He didn't know how to tell me this, he said, but his wife was afraid I might burn the place down. I might, he said, drop off with a cigarette burning in my fingers, or else leave a burner turned on. Anyway, they were afraid I would catch the house on fire, and he was sorry, but he couldn't let me stay. So I said, okay, and I unpacked my suitcase.
Wow. Carol said. Your own brother did that. He forsook you, she said. Your own brother.
I don't know what I'd have done if I'd been in his shoes, Nick said.
Sure you do,
Joanne said. Well, I guess I do, Nick said. Sure, I'd have let him stay there. What the hell, a house? What's that? You can get insurance on a house.
That's pretty amazing, all right, Robert said. So how do you and your brother get along these days?
We don't, I'm sorry to say. He asked me to lend him some money a while back, and I did, and he repaid me when he said he would. But we haven't seen each other in about 5 years. It's been longer than that since I've seen his wife.
Where are all these people coming from? Joanne said.
She got up from the table and went over to the window and moved the curtain. The kid said something about a fire, Nick said.
That's silly. There can't be a fire, Joanne said. Can there?
Something's going on, Robert said.
Nick went to the front door and opened it. A car slowed and then pulled up alongside the curb in front of the house and parked. Another car drove up and parked across the street. Small groups of people moved past down the sidewalk. Nick went out into the yard and the others, Joanne, Carol, and Robert, followed him. Nick looked up the street and saw the smoke, a crowd of people, and two fire engines and a police car parked at the intersection. Men were training hoses on the shell of a house. The carpenter house, Nick saw at a glance. Black smoke poured from the walls, and flames shot from the roof.
My God, there's a fire, all right, he said. The kids were right.
Why didn't we hear anything? Joanne said. Did you hear anything? I didn't hear anything.
We'd better go down and see about the girls, Robert, Carol said. They might get in the way somehow. They might get too close or something. Anything could happen.
The four of them started down the sidewalk. They fell in with some other people who were walking at an unhurried pace. They walked along with these other people. Nick had the feeling that they could have been on an outing. But all the while, as they kept their eyes on the burning house, they saw firemen pouring water onto the roof of the house, where flames kept breaking through. Some other firemen were holding a hose and aiming a stream of water through a front window. A fireman wearing a helmet with straps, a long black coat, and black knee-high boots was carrying an axe and moving around toward the back of the house. They came up to where the crowd of people stood watching. The police car had parked sideways in the middle of the road, and they could hear the radio crackling inside the car over the sound of the fire as it ripped through the walls of the house. Then Nick spotted the two girls standing near the front of the crowd, holding their skateboards.
There they are, he said to Robert. Over there, see them?
They made their way through the crowd, excusing themselves, and came up beside the girls.
We told you, Jenny said. See?
Megan stood holding her skateboard in one hand and had the thumb of her other hand planted in her mouth.
Do you know what happened? Nick said to the woman beside him. She was wearing a sun hat and smoking a cigarette.
Vandals, she said. That's what somebody told me anyway.
If they can catch them, they ought to kill them, if you ask me, said the man standing next to the woman. Or else lock them up and throw away the key. These people are traveling in Mexico and don't even know they won't have a house to live in when they come back. They haven't been able to get in touch with them. Those poor people. Can you imagine? They're going to come home to find out they don't have a house to live in any longer.
It's going, the fireman with the axe shouted. Stand back.
Nobody was close to him or to the house, but the people in the crowd moved their feet, and Nick could feel himself grow tense. Someone in the crowd said,
Oh my God, my God.
Look at it, someone else said.
Nick edged closer to Joanne, who was staring intently at the fire. The hair on her forehead appeared damp. He put his arm around her. He realized, as he did it, that he'd touched her this way at least 3 times that morning. Nick turned his head slightly in Robert's direction and was surprised to see Robert staring at him instead of the house. Robert's face was flushed, his expression stern, as if everything that had happened, arson, jail, betrayal, and adultery, the overturning of the established order, was Nick's fault and could be laid on his doorstep. Nick stared back, his arm around Joanne, until the flush left Robert's face and he lowered his eyes. When he raised them again, he didn't look at Nick. He moved closer to his wife, as if to protect her. Nick and Joanne were still holding each other as they watched, but there was that familiar feeling Nick would have from time to time as she absently patted his shoulder that he didn't know what she was thinking.
What are you thinking? He asked her.
I was thinking about Bill, she said.
He went on holding her. She didn't say any more for a minute, and then she said, I think about him every now and then, you know. After all, he was the first man I ever loved.
He kept holding her. She let her head rest on his shoulder and went on staring at the burning house.
Call if you need me.
We had both been involved with other people that spring, but when June came and school was out, we decided to let our house for the summer and move from Palo Alto to the north coast country of California. Our son Richard went to Nancy's grandmother's place in Pasco, Washington, to live for the summer and work towards saving money for college in the fall. His grandmother knew the situation at home and had begun working on getting him up there and locating him a job long before his arrival. She'd talked to a farmer friend of hers and had secured a promise of work for Richard baling hay and building fences. Hard work, but Richard was looking forward to it. He left on the bus in the morning of the day after his high school graduation. I took him to the station and parked and went inside to sit with him until his bus was called. His mother had already held him and cried and kissed him goodbye and given him a long letter that he was to deliver to his grandmother upon his arrival. She was at home now, finishing last-minute packing for our own move and waiting for the couple who were to take our house. I bought Richard's ticket, gave it to him, and we sat on one of the benches in the station and waited. We'd talked a little about things on the way to the station.
Are you and Mom going to get a divorce? He'd asked.
It was Saturday morning and there weren't many cars. Not if we can help it, I said. We don't want to. That's why we're going away from here and don't expect to see anyone all summer. That's why we've rented our house for the summer and rented the house up in Eureka. Why you're getting away too, I guess. One reason, anyway. Not to mention the fact that you'll come home with your pockets filled with money. We don't want to get a divorce. We want to be alone for the summer and try to work things out.
You still love Mom? He said. She told me she loves you.
Of course I do, I said. You ought to know that by now. We've just had our share of troubles and heavy responsibilities like everyone else, and now we need time to be alone and work things out. But don't worry about us. You just go up there and have a good summer and work hard and save your money. Consider it a vacation, too. Get in all the fishing you can. There's good fishing around there.
Water skiing, too, he said. I want to learn to water ski.
I've never been water skiing, I said. Do some of that for me, too, will you? We sat in the bus station. He looked through his yearbook while I held a newspaper in my lap. Then his bus was called and we stood up. I embraced him and said, Don't worry, don't worry. Where's your ticket? He patted his coat pocket and then picked up his suitcase. I walked him over to where the line was forming in the terminal, then I embraced him again and kissed him on the cheek and said goodbye.
Goodbye, Dad,
he said, and turned from me so I wouldn't see his tears. I drove home to where our boxes and suitcases were waiting in the living room. Nancy was in the kitchen drinking coffee with the young couple she'd found to take our house for the summer. I'd met the couple, Jerry and Liz, graduate students in math, for the first time a few days before. But we shook hands again, and I drank a cup of coffee that Nancy poured. We sat around the table and drank coffee while Nancy finished her list of things they should look out for or do at certain times of the month, the first and last of each month, where they should send any mail and the like. Nancy's face was tight. Sun fell through the curtain onto the table as it got later in the morning. Finally, things seemed to be in order, and I left the three of them in the kitchen and began loading the car. It was a furnished house we were going to, furnished right down to plates and cooking utensils, so we wouldn't need to take much with us from this house. Only the essentials. I'd driven up to Eureka, 350 miles north of Palo Alto, on the north coast of California, 3 weeks before and rented us the furnished house. I went with Susan, the woman I'd been seeing. We stayed in a motel at the edge of town for 3 nights while I looked in the newspaper and visited realtors. She watched me as I wrote out a check for the 3 months' rent. Later, back at the motel, in bed, she lay with her hand on her forehead and said,
I envy your wife. I envy Nancy. You hear people talk about the other woman always and how the incumbent wife has the privileges and the real power, but I never really understood or cared about those things before. Now I see. I envy her. I envy her the life she'll have with you in that house this summer. I wish it were me. I wish it were us. Oh, how I wish it were us. I feel so crummy, she said. I stroked her hair. Nancy was a tall, long-legged woman with brown hair and eyes and a generous spirit. But lately we had been coming up short on generosity and spirit. The man she'd been seeing was one of my colleagues, a divorced, dapper, three-piece suit and tie fellow with graying hair who drank too much and whose hands, some of my students told me, sometimes shook in the classroom. He and Nancy had drifted into their affair at a party during the holidays, not too long after Nancy had discovered my own affair. It all sounds boring and tacky now. It is boring and tacky. But during that spring, it was what it was, and it consumed all of our energies and concentration to the exclusion of everything else. Sometime in late April, we began to make plans to rent our house and go away for the summer, just the two of us, and try to put things back together if they could be put back together. We each agreed we would not call or write or otherwise be in touch with the other parties. So we made arrangements for Richard, found the couple to look after our house, and I had looked at a map and driven north from San Francisco and found Eureka, and a realtor who was willing to rent a furnished house to a respectable middle-aged married couple for the summer. I think I even used the phrase, second honeymoon to the realtor, God forgive me, while Susan smoked a cigarette and read tourist brochures out in the car. I finished storing the suitcases, bags, and cartons in the trunk and back seat, and waited while Nancy said a final goodbye on the porch. She shook hands with each of them and turned and came toward the car. I waved to the couple, and they waved back. Nancy got in and shut the door. Let's go,
she said. I put the car in gear, and we headed for the freeway. At the light, just before the freeway, we saw a car ahead of us come off the freeway trailing a broken muffler, the sparks flying.
Look at that, Nancy said. It might catch fire.
We waited and watched until the car managed to pull off the road onto the shoulder. We stopped at a little cafe off the highway near Sebastopol. Eat and gas, the sign read. We laughed at the sign. I pulled up in front of the cafe and we went inside and took a table near a window in the back. After we ordered coffee and sandwiches, Nancy touched her forefinger to the table and began tracing lines in the wood. I lit a cigarette and looked outside. I saw rapid movement, and then I realized I was looking at a hummingbird in the bush beside the window. Its wings moved in a blur of motion, and it kept dipping its beak into a blossom on the bush. Nancy, look, I said. There's a hummingbird. But the hummingbird flew at this moment, and Nancy looked and said, Where? I don't see it. It was just there a minute ago, I said. Look, there it is. Another one, I think. It's another hummingbird. We watched the hummingbird until the waitress brought our order, and the bird flew at the movement and disappeared around the building. Now that's a good sign, I think, I said. Hummingbirds. Hummingbirds are supposed to bring luck.
I heard that somewhere, she said. I don't know where I heard that, but I've heard it. Well, she said, luck is what we could use, wouldn't you say?
They're a good sign, I said. I'm glad we stopped here. She nodded. She waited a minute. Then she took a bite of her sandwich. We reached Eureka just before dark. We passed the motel on the highway where Susan and I had stayed and had spent the 3 nights 2 weeks before, then turned off the highway and took a road up a hill overlooking the town. I had the house keys in my pocket. We drove over the hill, and for a mile or so, until we came to a little intersection with a service station and a grocery store. There were wooded mountains ahead of us in the valley, and pasture land all around. Some cattle were grazing in a field behind the service station.
This is pretty country, Nancy said. I'm anxious to see the house.
Almost there, I said. It's just down this road, I said, and over that rise. Here, I said in a minute and pulled into a long driveway with hedge on either side. Here it is. What do you think of this? I'd asked the same question of Susan when she and I had stopped in the driveway.
It's nice, Nancy said. It looks fine, it does. Let's get out.
We stood in the front yard a minute and looked around.
Then we went up the porch steps and I unlocked the front door and turned on the lights. We went through the house. There were two small bedrooms, a bath, a living room with old furniture and a fireplace, and a big kitchen with a view of the valley. "Do you like it?" I said.
"I think it's just wonderful," Nancy said. She grinned. "I'm glad you found it. I'm glad we're here."
She opened the refrigerator and ran a finger over the counter.
"Thank God, it looks clean enough. I won't have to do any cleaning."
"Right down to clean sheets on the beds," I said. "I checked. I made sure. That's the way they're renting it. Pillows, even. And pillowcases, too."
"We'll have to buy some firewood," she said.
We were standing in the living room.
"We'll want to have a fire on nights like this."
"I'll look into firewood tomorrow," I said. "We can go shopping then, too, and see the town." She looked at me and said,
"I'm glad we're here."
"So am I," I said. I opened my arms and she moved to me. I held her. I could feel her trembling. I turned her face up and kissed her on either cheek. "Nancy," I said.
"I'm glad we're here," she said.
We spent the next few days settling in, taking trips into Eureka to walk around and look in store windows, and hiking across the pasture land behind the house all the way to the woods. We bought groceries, and I found an ad in the newspaper for firewood, called, and a day or so afterwards, two young men with long hair delivered a pickup truckload of alder and stacked it in the carport. That night, we sat in front of the fireplace after dinner and drank coffee and talked about getting a dog.
"I don't want a pup," Nancy said. "Something we have to clean up after, or that will chew things up. That we don't need. But I'd like to have a dog, yes. We haven't had a dog in a long time. I think we could handle a dog up here," she said.
"And after we go back, after summer's over?" I said. I rephrased the question. "What about keeping a dog in the city?"
"We'll see. Meanwhile, let's look for a dog. The right kind of dog. I don't know what I want until I see it. We'll read the classifieds and we'll go to the pound if we have to."
But though we went on talking about dogs for several days and pointed out dogs to each other in people's yards we'd drive past, dogs we said we'd like to have, nothing came of it. We didn't get a dog. Nancy called her mother and gave her our address and telephone number. Richard was working and seemed happy, her mother said. She herself was fine. I heard Nancy say,
"We're fine. This is good medicine."
One day in the middle of July, we were driving the highway near the ocean and came over a rise to see some lagoons that were closed off from the ocean by sand spits. There were some people fishing from shore and two boats out on the water. I pulled the car off onto the shoulder and stopped. "Let's see what they're fishing for," I said. "Maybe we could get some gear and go ourselves."
"We haven't been fishing in years," Nancy said. "Not since that time Richard was little and we went camping near Mount Shasta. Do you remember that?"
"I remember," I said. "I just remembered, too, that I've missed fishing. Let's walk down and see what they're fishing for." "Trout," the man said when I asked. "Cutthroats and rainbow trout. Even some steelhead and a few salmon. They come in here in the winter when the spit opens, and then when it closes in the spring, they're trapped. This is a good time of the year for them. I haven't caught any today, but last Sunday I caught 4, about 15 inches long. Best eating fish in the world, and they put up a hell of a fight. Fellows out in the boats have caught some today, but so far I haven't done anything."
"What do you use for bait?" Nancy asked.
"Anything," the man said. "Worms, salmon eggs, whole kernel corn. Just get it out there and leave it lay on the bottom. Pull out a little slack and watch your line." We hung around a little longer and watched the man fish and watched the little boats chat-chat back and forth the length of the lagoon. "Thanks," I said to the man. "Good luck to you." "Good luck to you," he said. "Good luck to the both of you." We stopped at a sporting goods store on the way back to town and bought licenses, inexpensive rods and reels, nylon line, hooks, leaders, sinkers, and a creel. We made plans to go fishing the next morning. But that night, after we'd eaten dinner and washed the dishes and I had laid a fire in the fireplace,
Nancy shook her head and said it wasn't going to work.
Why do you say that? I asked. What is it you mean?
I mean it isn't going to work. Let's face it.
She shook her head again.
I don't think I want to go fishing in the morning either, and I don't want a dog. No, no dogs. I think I want to go up and see my mother and Richard. Alone. I want to be alone. I miss Richard.
She said and began to cry.
Richard's my son, my baby,
she said.
And he's nearly grown and gone. I miss him.
And Del? Do you miss Del Schrader, too? I said. Your boyfriend, do you miss him?
I miss everybody tonight,
she said.
I miss you, too. I've missed you for a long time now. I've missed you so much, you've gotten lost somehow. I can't explain it. I've lost you. You're not mine any longer.
Nancy, I said.
No, no,
she said. She shook her head. She sat on the sofa in front of the fire and kept shaking her head.
I want to fly up and see my mother and Richard tomorrow. After I'm gone, you can call your girlfriend.
I won't do that, I said. I have no intention of doing that.
You'll call her, she said.
You'll call Del, I said. I felt rubbishy for saying it.
You can do what you want,
she said, wiping her eyes on her sleeve.
I mean that. I don't want to sound hysterical, but I'm going up to Washington tomorrow. Right now I'm going to go to bed. I'm exhausted. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for both of us, Dan. We're not going to make it. That fisherman today, he wished us good luck.
She shook her head.
I wish us good luck, too. We're going to need it.
She went into the bathroom and I heard water running in the tub. I went out and sat on the porch steps and smoked a cigarette. It was dark and quiet outside. I looked toward town and could see a faint glow of lights in the sky and patches of ocean fog drifting in the valley. I began to think of Susan. A little later, Nancy came out of the bathroom and I heard the bedroom door close. I went inside and put another block of wood on the grate and waited until the flames began to move up the bark. Then I went into the other bedroom and turned the covers back and stared at the floral design on the sheets. Then I showered, dressed in my pajamas, and went to sit near the fireplace again. The fog was outside the window now. I sat in front of the fire and smoked. When I looked out the window again, something moved in the fog, and I saw a horse grazing in the front yard. I went to the window. The horse looked up at me for a minute, then went back to pulling up grass. Another horse walked past the car into the yard and began to graze. I turned on the porch light and stood at the window and watched them. They were big white horses with long manes. They'd gotten through a fence or an unlocked gate from one of the nearby farms. Somehow they'd wound up in our front yard. They were larking it, enjoying their breakaway immensely. But nervous, too. I could see the whites of their eyes from where I stood behind the window. Their ears kept rising and falling as they tore out clumps of grass. A third horse wandered into the yard and then a fourth. It was a herd of white horses, and they were grazing in our front yard. I went into the bedroom and woke Nancy. Her eyes were red and the skin around her eyes was swollen. She had her hair up in curlers and a suitcase lay open on the floor near the foot of the bed. Nancy, I said. Honey, come and see what's in the front yard. Come and see this. You must see this. You won't believe it. Hurry up.
What is it?
She said.
Don't hurt me. What is it?
Honey, you must see this. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm sorry if I scared you, but you must come out here and see something. I went back into the other room and stood in front of the window. And in a few minutes, Nancy came in tying her robe. She looked out the window and said,
My God, they're beautiful. Where'd they come from, Dan? They're just beautiful.
They must have gotten loose from around here somewhere, I said. One of those farm places. I'll call the sheriff's department pretty soon and let them locate the owners. But I wanted you to see this first.
Will they bite?
She said.
I'd like to pet that one there, the one that just looked at us. I'd like to pat that one's shoulder, but I don't want to get bitten. I'm going outside.
I don't think they'll bite, I said. They don't look like the kind of horses that'll bite. But put a coat on if you're going out there. It's cold. I put my coat on over my pajamas and waited for Nancy. Then I opened the front door and we went outside and walked into the yard with the horses. They all looked up at us. Two of them went back to pulling up grass. One of the other horses snorted and moved back a few steps. And then it, too, went back to pulling up grass and chewing, head down. I rubbed the forehead of one horse and patted its shoulder. It kept chewing. Nancy put out her hand and began stroking the mane of another horse.
"Horsey, where'd you come from?"
she said.
"Where do you live and why are you out tonight, horsey?"
she said, and kept stroking the horse's mane. The horse looked at her and blew through its lips and dropped its head again. She patted its shoulder. "I guess I'd better call the sheriff," I said.
"Not yet,"
she said.
"Not for a while yet. We'll never see anything like this again. We'll never, never have horses in our front yard again. Wait a while yet, Dan."
A little later, Nancy was still out there moving from one horse to another, patting their shoulders and stroking their manes, when one of the horses moved from the yard into the driveway and walked around the car and down the driveway toward the road, and I knew I had to call. In a little while, the two sheriff's cars showed up with their red lights flashing in the fog, and a few minutes later, a fellow in a sheepskin coat driving a pickup with a horse trailer behind it. Now the horses shied and tried to get away, and the man with the horse trailer swore and tried to get a rope around the neck of one horse.
"Don't hurt it,"
Nancy said. We went back in the house and stood behind the window and watched the deputies and the rancher work on getting the horses rounded up. "I'm going to make some coffee," I said. "Would you like some coffee, Nancy?"
"I'll tell you what I'd like," she said. "I feel high, Dan. I feel like I'm loaded. I feel like, I don't know, but I like the way I'm feeling. You put on some coffee and I'll find us some music to listen to on the radio and then you can build up the fire again. I'm too excited to sleep."
So we sat in front of the fire and drank coffee and listened to an all-night radio station from Eureka and talked about the horses and then talked about Richard and Nancy's mother. We danced. We didn't talk about the present situation at all. The fog hung outside the window and we talked and were kind with one another. Toward daylight, I turned off the radio and we went to bed and made love. The next afternoon, after her arrangements were made and her suitcases packed, I drove her to the little airport where she would catch a flight to Portland and then transfer to another airline that would put her in Pasco late that night. "Tell your mother I said hello. Give Richard a hug for me and tell him I miss him," I said. "Tell him I send love."
"He loves you too,"
she said.
"You know that. In any case, you'll see him in the fall, I'm sure."
I nodded.
"Goodbye,"
she said and reached for me. We held each other.
"I'm glad for last night," she said. "Those horses, our talk, everything. It helps. We won't forget that,"
she said. She began to cry. "Write me, will you?" I said. "I didn't think it would happen to us," I said. "All those years. I never thought so for a minute. Not us."
"All right," she said. "Some big letters. The biggest you've ever seen since I used to send you letters in high school."
"I'll be looking for them," I said. Then she looked at me again and touched my face. She turned and moved across the tarmac toward the plane. "Go, dearest one, and God be with you." She boarded the plane and I stayed around until its jet engines started, and in a minute the plane began to taxi down the runway. It lifted off over Humboldt Bay and soon became a speck on the horizon. I drove back to the house and parked in the driveway and looked at the hoof prints of the horses from last night. There were deep impressions in the grass and gashes, and there were piles of dung. Then I went into the house and, without even taking off my coat, went to the telephone and dialed Susan's number.